From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Investigators in California are learning more about the gunman they say shot and killed 12 people last night at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks outside L.A. Those who were killed include Sergeant Ron Helas, a 29-year veteran of the force. He's being honored as a motorcade carries his body from the scene. We're also hearing the stories of survivors and residents. Lance Orozco is news director at KCLU in Thousand Oaks. And Lance, both resident and reporter today. So describe how this has hit your town.
Well, people are in shock. I think it's one of those universal things. No matter where it happens, people say, well, it can't happen here. It shouldn't happen here. But really in Thousand Oaks, which is a suburb, it's about 40 miles northwest of Los Angeles. The crime rate is very low here. Murders are very uncommon. So to have something on this scale and scope just has left people overwhelmed.
The sheriff there, Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean, has been struggling through tears all day. As we said, one of the dead, his own sergeant. But Sheriff Dean says the shooter first shot a security guard outside the bar. Do we know more about what happened?
Well, we're putting the pieces together. We know that he's a former Marine. We know that he's 28 years old. And we know that basically when he came to this bar, he basically walked up to some of the security guards that were outside and started shooting and went inside and started shooting. It all happened very quickly and without any warning, with any provocation that we know of. And Sheriff Dean had told us earlier this morning, he said, we can't figure out why this particular place was targeted. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of months ago, he actually had been in an altercation at another bar in this area, and he was actually the victim, but it wasn't this bar. It was a different place. So right now, we don't have a clear-cut motive for this attack.
Well, and the alleged shooter has had other contact with police. We're not naming him because we don't want to give infamy to that name that he may have wanted. But police say he was 28, a resident of Newbury Park, a Marine Corps vet, again, contact with law and maybe mental health officials?
Yes, but his contact with the law was for relatively minor offenses, mm-hmm. and the same thing with the mental health issue. I mean, it was something that didn't require, as far as we can tell, like a hospitalization or anything like that. And so there's nothing that really points to some type of a large problem.
Well, this was college country night, Wednesday nights at this bar, lots of underage young people. You spoke with some of the survivors. Let's listen.
I just heard 18 to 20 rounds at a time. That's all I heard before I got out.
Our main concern was just take cover, hoping that all of our friends that were in there also could get out safe. It was such a blur. I don't even know what to think of it still.
Well, Lance, just horrifying. And then, of course, we heard of the parents who came to this place and couldn't get answers for the longest time about where their kids were. How's that going?
Hey, it's still difficult because there still is some confusion. It's been long enough now that a lot of that's been sorted out. Of course, the hardest thing is for the people that have kids that aren't going to come home, and that's difficult. We, at this point, don't have the names of those who died as a result of this incident. We may not even have those until tomorrow at the rate things are going. So it's a very difficult situation for the families, and especially because, again, these are, a lot of these were college-age kids. And so they weren't necessarily going home to their parents. Parents didn't know right away that they were involved in something like this.
Yeah. We mentioned the Sheriff Sergeant Ron Helas, one of the first officers to respond, shot after he entered the bar. He later died at the hospital. Tell us more about him.
Well, okay, very popular member of the department. And you got to realize that this is not really a huge department. I mean, it's not a small department, but it's not a big one. Everybody knows everybody here, and especially somebody who's been with the department almost three decades. He was just maybe a year away from retirement, and the sheriff got very emotional talking about this because he said, hey, he and I used to, we work out together sometimes, mm-hmm. we go to the gym together sometimes. And, he was so close to retirement, and ironically, the sheriff, his last day is tomorrow. He's actually retiring tomorrow after more than three decades in law enforcement himself. And and this is his last act as sheriff is to be dealing with this.
Yeah, to honor his friend. Look, Sheriff Dean also said that after the shootings at the synagogue in Pittsburgh, he called that rabbi. And so this has to have been on his mind, this possibility, and here it is. Lance Orozco, again, news director at KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California, a city that, as you describe it, a town that seems shattered by a shooting, 12 dead, 13, including the shooter who was found killed by a bullet, probably from his own hand. Lance, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, as we continue to follow the news from Thousand Oaks, we're also looking at the new landscape in Washington after the midterm elections. Two Native American women made history on Tuesday. Charisse Davids, a citizen of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and Deb Holland, a citizen of the Laguna Pueblo tribe, both won seats in the House of Representatives, becoming America's first ever Native American congresswoman. Deb Holland, representative-elect to New Mexico's 1st District, joins us from Albuquerque. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's listen to a clip from the victory speech that you gave on Tuesday night in Albuquerque.
Growing up in my mother's Pueblo household and as a 35th generation New Mexican, I never imagined a world where I would be represented by someone who looks like me. Tonight, New Mexico, you are sending one of the very first Native American women to Congress.
Why do you think it has taken so long for a Native woman to be elected to Congress?
Well, first of all, it's not for lack of trying. There have been many Native women who have run, who have not won their seats for whatever various reasons. I felt like it was the right time to run. I have been working in politics here in New Mexico for close to 20 years, organizing, you know, getting folks out to the polls. And it takes long because it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do, right? You have to raise money. You have to assemble a team. You have to, I mean, you're working on your campaign, you know, 18 to 20 hours a day. It's just a difficult undertaking. And for a lot of women who have other obligations, I'm sure it's just a difficult undertaking. So I'm grateful that I was able to assemble a terrific team, that I have the family support to take this endeavor. And so, yes, I'm very happy with the result.
You know, you're joining us from New Mexico, where it's only been a matter of decades that Native people have had full suffrage there. What do you think it means for your Native constituents to see someone like you elected to Congress?
Right. So here in New Mexico, actually, Miguel Trujillo, he sued the state of New Mexico in 1948 for Indians' right to vote. Nonetheless, that was only 70 years ago. So we don't have as much practice, if you will, getting to the polls. But I think that it might be a turning point in our politics. We have a number of Native American representatives at the state legislature, which is really good. I hope to see that more Native women will step up and run for office. And I will be there to help them. You know, running for Congress, there was no Native woman in Congress that I could go to and say, help me.
Right.
Tell me what to do. How do I navigate this? I hope to be that person for Native women running in the future.
So what do you want to do when you get there? What's on your agenda?
I want to work on climate change. I want to fight climate change. I want to move New Mexico into a global renewable energy leader. We need a renewable energy revolution in this country, right? We have, 22 years before climate change is irreversible, but we're not going to wait that long. We have to start working on it right now.
What kind of hurdles do you think you're going to face? Because, as you know, the Democrats are going to take control of the House, but the Senate will still be in Republican hands. And, of course, the White House is still in Republican hands.
Yes, that shouldn't stop us from moving forward with our agenda. You know, the Democrats can work on a infrastructure plan that is very, very, very heavy on renewable energy. I mean, there's a lot of things we can do. The Affordable Care Act is still the law. We can make sure that we are ensuring that folks can take advantage of that. That, you know, right now the Republicans, they don't advertise open enrollment, for example. They don't, you know, they're trying to dismantle it piece by piece. And I think the Democrats can be there to absolutely protect existing laws and, you know, fight bad legislation when it comes up.
Do you want the tax cuts repealed?
I do.
Fully.
Yes. I mean, look, right now, the tax plan that was passed by the Republicans, it's not paying for itself. It's ballooning into almost $2 trillion deficit for our country. Imagine what we could have done with that money.
There were also some high-profile Democratic losses, though. President Trump said yesterday that he thought that it was a very good night for Republicans, too. What do you think that was part of the message?
Well, he would say that. He would say that. But, you know, we won a number of governor's races. We flipped a number of state houses. We here in New Mexico, Democrats won up and down the ballot. Every single statewide seat is held by a Democrat. We won our judge seats. We did an excellent job here in New Mexico, and it was a good night for Democrats.
That is Deb Holland, who is the representative-elect to New Mexico's 1st District. Thank you so much, and congratulations again.
Thank you, too. Have a nice day.
And let's turn now to that contentious White House press conference yesterday. Reporters pressing President Trump with questions, the president telling them to sit down, give up the mic, and berating CNN's Jim Acosta. Well, last night, Acosta was told his White House credentials had been revoked because he'd laid hands on a female intern trying to take the microphone from him. Well, he and others there say he did not touch the intern. We'll post the video at hearnow.org. It seems to back that up. Let's bring in NPR media analyst David Folkenflik. David, what's your sense of this?
I think this was a very willful effort by the president to change the subject from the painful reality. While the two parties split control of Congress, what it means for Democrats to take over the House is it's going to be a very tumultuous 2 years with a lot of oversight and a lot of unwelcome inquiries into his behavior and that of his associates. This is a way to remind his supporters and the rest of the country that he defines a different political foe and finds them in the press corps. It's a way of diverting our attention, and it's successful.
Well, many of his most ardent supporters were cheering on this moment, but let's listen to a little of it. And first, I want to set it up. This is when Jim Acosta got up to ask about why the president said that the caravan of migrants was an invasion. As Jim Acosta said, it's not an invasion. It's a group of migrants making their way here. They're hundreds of miles away. Are you demonizing immigrants? And the president said, no, I consider it an invasion. They have to come legally. We do need people to work. And then Acosta asked him about the ad that featured migrants. The president said, they're not actors. And then said, you should let me run the country. You run CNN. And it came to this moment.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question.
You hear that moment there where Jim Acosta says, pardon me, ma'am. That's where he's saying to the young intern, wait, I'm going to finish my question.
That's enough.
And then he went on to try to ask another question. And the exchange ended with this.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
David Folkenflik, right after that, Peter Alexander from NBC tried to defend Jim Acosta, trying to ask the question. Others said answer his question. There are others, as we're going to hear in the room, who were siding with the president. But your thoughts on that moment?
Well, it's an incredibly ugly moment to call a reporter who's asking basically legitimate questions each and every time. A terrible person, I think, strikes a blow against the idea that journalists play a role in civil society. And as we've seen with shootings in Annapolis that were deadly, attempted mail bombing sent to CNN in recent weeks, you know, the president gives comfort to authoritarian figures that would seek to stifle dissent but also stifle accountability through journalism in their own countries. And I think this is problematic, even as it is, as I said earlier, something of a distraction.
Well, but here's Trish Regan on the Fox Business Network criticizing Acosta. Let's listen.
I'm upset about that this guy doesn't have enough manners to know that he's already gotten his questions and that there are other reporters in the room and there are additional questions that need to be asked.
But there were other moments in the press conference. There was the president's reaction to the Haitian-American PBS News reporter Yamiche Alcindor, who asked him about labeling himself a nationalist in the run-up to the midterms.
Now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? I mean, why do I have my highest poll numbers? That's such a racist question.
David?
I mean, brutal moment. To her credit, she's asking a legitimate question, and it's not the first time the president has faced that question. The question is, she's asking why are white nationalists finding comfort in his rhetoric, particularly after he called himself simply a nationalist.
And that's not anecdotal. They are saying as much on all the white nationalist websites.
Yeah, on the record. Mm-hmm. And the president is citing a finding comfort in a poll from Rasmussen that appears to be at best an outlier. You know, look, the president is signaling his contempt and he's projecting on the reporter who's asking the question, a reporter of color, the accusation that he fears is being lodged against him. You know, unlike Acosta's approach, Alcindor just pressed on and she asked her question, asked another substantive question. That said, I don't think Acosta's approach deserved the response. And also, let's be clear, the president's press secretary circulated a video of it that appeared to have been doctored by an editor at InfoWars, the outlet of Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist who's been banned from Facebook and other social media platforms for being disingenuous and dishonest. You know, that's an astonishing source for the White House to rely upon in making a case that itself is astonishing, which is against a reporter.
What should happen now, David Folkenflik? Very briefly, Jim Acosta having his credentials taken away indefinitely. Some have said that maybe other reporters should just not show up at the midday White House press conferences. Others are saying ignore it. What should happen?
You know, there's a balance because it's as though reporters are saying we're going to take away this oxygen which you want so dearly, not necessarily acknowledging the fact that maybe the way in which they give oxygen to false assertions that are being made are themselves journalistic judgment calls that could be revisited. I do think that it is totally legitimate for White House press reporters to decide whether or not they want to participate in a system that does that. I would like to see a whole lot more enterprise reporting by the folks who cover the White House anyway, not from necessarily the official spokespeople.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
And now let's get the latest from Washington on the hospitalization of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the forced resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and possible recounts in Florida and Georgia. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
So Justice Ginsburg, 85, she fell last night at the court. We heard broke some ribs. What are you hearing?
Yeah, the Supreme Court confirmed this morning that she was working in her office at the Supreme Court. She fell and she broke three ribs and that she was hospitalized at a hospital here in Washington, D.C. We don't know much more than that. But remember, Justice Ginsburg is the oldest member of the court, but has had other health issues in the past. She actually broke ribs in 2012, and that wasn't disclosed until later. And she's survived multiple bouts of cancer. And she's somebody who, though, let's remember, also is famously known for her workout routine
her fitness,
and keeping herself
and her
fit.
Personal trainers, yeah. So we'll keep an eye on that and send good wishes. We're learning more about former prosecutor Matt Whitaker, the acting attorney general now leading the FBI special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation after Jeff Sessions' forced resignation yesterday. On CNN last year, before Whitaker joined the Justice Department, he floated this idea of underfunding the Russia investigation as a way to stop it.
So I could see a scenario where Jeff Sessions is replaced with a recess appointment, and that attorney general doesn't fire Bob Mueller, but he just reduces the budget so low that his investigation grinds to almost a halt.
To dwindle.
Of course, Democrats are thinking that might be the plan now. And Whitaker also once chaired a political campaign for former Trump advisor Sam Clovis, who's testified in the Russia investigation. Democrats are calling for him to recuse himself. What's happening here?
Yeah, well, Democrats noticed that obviously that a couple of op-eds that Whitaker had written. Whitaker had said that he thinks that Mueller was going too far. Quote: looking at the president's personal finances, he thinks that that would be too far. He wrote that in a CNN op-ed last August in 2017, not 2018. He also defended the firing of Jim Comey. He said that there was a legitimate reason to potentially look at indicting Hillary Clinton for her email scandal. So Democrats feel like since he's publicly made these kinds of statements that he should recuse himself. There's no legal responsibility for him to do so. I've seen others say that if they were a judge and ruling on issues like this, then maybe they would. But he's not legally required to. And I do not think that he will, given that this president was so upset with Jeff Sessions for having recused himself for his contacts and ties to the Russian ambassador who he'd met with. So that's why Democrats are feeling the way they are about Whitaker. You know, it's not a far loop to think that Democrats that Whitaker will take a lighter hand when it comes to this Russia investigation than allowing it to go full bore.
Okay. So we'll keep an eye on that. There was a moment in Georgia we want to note. The governor there, Nathan Deal, introduced the Secretary of State Brian Kemp at a podium, and we'll explain why. Well, this is just before Kemp said he would step aside as Secretary of State. That was the big news of the day. Of course, that race for governor in turmoil, but it hasn't been decided yet. And here's what Governor Deal said as he introduced Brian Kemp.
And it is my honor at this time to introduce to you the soon-to-be new governor of the state of Georgia, Brian Kemp.
Well, but the Democrat, Stacey Abrams, hasn't conceded. What's going on there?
Well, Deal's a Republican, and he endorsed, Kemp, and it's not that surprising to sort of, in a tongue-in-cheek way, say, here's the soon-to-be governor since he's ahead. And you noted Stacey Abrams has not conceded and that there are thousands of absentee and provisional ballots that are yet to be counted. You know, Kemp did say that he would step aside from any kind of further counts or recount if it came to that.
Yeah, well, the Florida Republican Ron DeSantis has been declared the winner in that state's governor's race. But there's the Democrat Andrew Gillum. Is that edging towards a recount?
Yeah, the Gillum DeSantis race would go to a recount if they were separated by 0.5 percentage points. It's currently 0.7, so it's kind of getting to that point. The Senate race is actually within that margin for recount already, so we'll see what happens there.
Okay, you have two other high profile races undecided: the Florida Senate race, as you mentioned, Republican Rick Scott, and the Democrat Bill Nelson. The Arizona Senate race between the Republican Martha McSally and the Democrat Kyrsten Sinema also undecided. Do you think, just briefly, Republicans have the advantage in both?
Well, they're leading, so they do have the advantage. McSally has a lead of about 15,000 votes over Sinema, but there are some 600,000 mail-in ballots that have not been counted yet, and that could take about a week or more to complete.
Okay, you only have 20 seconds left. You've been talking about this for 2 days straight. Anything else you want to add? You probably want to take a breather.
You know, I just would remind people that Democrats taking over the House is a huge, huge deal. And while liberals may have not gotten everything they wanted, taking over the House is a big
deal,
thing.
As we're going to see. Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
After losing elections, most people concede and move on. But Glenn Devlin, a Republican district court judge in Harris County, Texas, who lost re-election on Tuesday, decided to release at least seven juvenile defendants who came before him, saying that's what the voters wanted. Devlin asked the minors if they planned to kill anybody. When they said no, he let them go. Here's public defender Stephen Halpert on ABC 13 News.
He made a comment that this is obviously what the voters wanted. And I think the implication there is that by electing all Democratic judges, there's this belief that Democratic judges are going to be soft on crime.
Joining us now is Davis Land, reporter at Houston Public Media. Davis, what happened here?
Right. So it's clear that this judge saw his being sent out of office as a message. Now, immediately after that, Harris County District Attorney Kim Ogg came out with a statement saying that they opposed the wholesale release of violent offenders at any age and saying that it could endanger the public. Stephen Halpert, the public defender that we heard there just a second ago, we spoke with him this morning. He says it's not unusual to release kids in this court, but the manner, he said, was unusual and that Judge Devlin was proving a point.
Well, and who were these people who were released? Are they people who should have stayed in detention?
So there are at least seven kids. Four of them are reportedly facing aggravated robbery charges, and some of them were seeing minor offenses. Now, again, it's not unusual to release kids before trial if they have a clear plan and the court knows where they're going to be. But in this method, just kind of wholesale releasing kids is very unusual and isn't typically done, especially in Devlin's court.
Well, tell us about Glenn Devlin. What is his reputation as a judge?
So he's been on the court since 2010 and presides over the juvenile gang court there. He's known for favoring incarceration as opposed to other sentences. A Houston Chronicle investigation earlier this year found that Devlin and one other judge account for more than one-fifth of all the kids that are sent to state prison in Texas last year.
Now, Devlin was one of 59 Republican jurists in Harris County who lost re-election on Tuesday. Why was there such a Democratic sweep? Is this just the Beto O'Rourke effect?
Yeah, it appears that high turnout and people selecting straight party tickets are a large cause of this kind of Democratic sweep in Harris County. For a long time, the city of Houston has been Democratic, but Harris County as a whole tends to vote more conservative. Even Harris County Judge Ed Emmett, who presides over the whole county, he's the county's top elected official, was swept out of office and is being replaced by a 27-year-old Democrat here who's never held office. So it appears that a lot of people are voting straight ticket Democrat, and that's showing up in the results.
So did Democrats run on a platform of being soft on crime or reforming the system?
Not typically. A big talking point for Democrats, especially in criminal justice in Houston, is that they are hard on crime because that's so often a line used against them.
Davis, just bigger picture here. How does it feel in Texas a couple days after a Democrat almost won statewide? As we look at the state from the rest of the country, it looks like maybe there's been some kind of a shift there.
It does. And it seems that high turnout is driving that more people are amped up about politics right now and that more people are turning out to vote. And we certainly see a lot of activity and a lot of enthusiasm going forward for future elections in both parties here.
That's Davis Land, a reporter at Houston Public Media. Thank you.
Thank you.
Growing demand for natural gas and renewable energy is hitting coal companies hard, despite the Trump administration's promise to revive the coal industry. The latest sign of trouble is the bankruptcy of Westmoreland Coal Company, one of the largest and oldest coal producers in North America. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
In southwest Wyoming, the Kimmer Coal Mine is the largest employer in Lincoln County. It's owned by Westmoreland, whose recent bankruptcy has locals on edge. Mike Delpaz represents employees there at the United Mine Workers of America.
Our people are just worried to death about their jobs, their pensions, their health care.
The Kimmer Mine employs about 280 people and provides benefits to many more, like retirees and widows. It's not clear yet what the bankruptcy means or whether anyone could lose their job. The same concerns go beyond Wyoming. Westmoreland has nearly 3,000 employees in seven states plus Canada. Delpaz says there are still a lot of unknowns.
Well, it is most certainly chaotic. We're not too sure that they're sure what they're doing.
The bankruptcy itself was expected. Westmoreland hired restructuring advisors last spring and have been seeing difficulties for much longer. It's purchased large mines that didn't pan out. Westmoreland's debt shot up to over $1 billion. Its share price tanked. Energy analysts say the company's business strategy was flawed. The mines relied on selling its coal to one primary customer, a nearby coal-fired power plant. That's instead the more typical strategy of sending coal to wherever the demand is.
The idea is to remove some of the market volatility and have a secure customer. What has turned out to be a good and sound strategy has turned into somewhat of a problem for them.
That's Andy Blumenfeld, an analyst with Doyle Trading Consultants. I spoke with him last May about Westmoreland's struggles. Several of the company's primary customers moved away from coal, and now more are scheduled to do the same thing. Wyoming's Kimmer Mine serves a coal-fired power plant, which is expected to retire one of its generating units this coming January. Another major customer of Westmoreland is closing down half its coal-fired generating units by 2022, another by 2027. Blumenfeld says its dependence on this mine mouth system was a fatal flaw.
It's kind of a sad situation. This is a mainline coal company. You know, Westmoreland is a name that's been around for a very long time.
The fall of coal-fired power plants, like the ones that rely on Westmoreland's coal, is part of a larger trend. Utilities are closing them in unprecedented numbers, moving towards natural gas and renewable energy. In 2009, there were 530 active coal plants. This past March, 262. That means over half of all plants retired in just 9 years. It comes despite the Trump administration's efforts to bolster coal, with the Clean Power Plan repeal, leaving the Paris Accord, not to mention an attempt to immediately save struggling coal plants from closing. Delpaz says he was hopeful.
What we all heard during, I guess maybe you call it your campaigns, coal was going to get a heck of a shot in the arm. Well, it hasn't.
A group of lenders now in charge of Westmoreland is expected to hold on to only two of the company's mines, one in New Mexico, the other in Montana. Smaller operations, including Kemmer, will likely be auctioned off, and ideally kept running by another operator, according to a Westmoreland spokeswoman, meaning jobs will be retained. The company said no layoffs were expected as a result of its restructuring announcement. But Peter Morgan, senior attorney with the Sierra Club, doesn't believe it.
I do not expect many of those mines to continue operating post-bankruptcy. And so that's going to mean certainly some layoffs.
Beyond jobs, if the Kemmer mine is closed or sold without certain assurances, environmental advocates like Morgan are worried what that means for reclamation costs and tax revenue. The Lincoln County Treasurer said Westmoreland's bankruptcy could lead to $11 million in unpaid taxes. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
And let's get an update now on the new question that Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross okayed for the 2020 U.S. Census. Is this person a citizen of the United States? The question has launched six lawsuits against the government in what could be one of the most important legal battles of the decade, because the census count is used to figure out how many seats in the House states have, how federal dollars for things like Medicare and school aid are handed out. The first trial started this week in a Manhattan federal court where NPR correspondent Hansi Lo Wang has been hunkered down. Hansi, first, how did this question come to be on the census?
The question was added by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau. He announced in March that he approved a Justice Department request for this question. And now the Census Bureau is working on plans to include this question on the forms for the 2020 census.
Well, and the Constitution says federal officials can design a census the way they see fit. And the Trump administration's Department of Justice says it wants this information to improve enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. How so?
Well, the Trump administration says it wants better citizenship data, specifically to enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has protections against discrimination of minorities, racial minorities and language minorities specifically. And the way it uses citizenship data to do that, the federal government uses this data to do that, is basically it needs to figure out how many citizens there are who are old enough to vote in a legislative district, and it needs to test out, you know, if a minority group's voting power has been diluted. And a way to do that is that you need to have citizenship data. But the thing is that for the entire history of the Voting Rights Act, which was enacted in 1965, for that entire history, the federal government has used citizenship data from a Census Bureau survey that went to some households, not all. And the survey is now known as the American Community Survey, which does include a citizenship question, the same one that the Trump administration wants to add to the 2020 census. But the key is that this information has come from a representative sample of the U.S. population, right, not from every household. And the administration says, you know, by relying on American Community Survey data, that's not comprehensive enough. But the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, as well as civil rights groups who watch voting rights cases very closely, they are very skeptical of that reasoning. Yeah. First, because the Trump administration has not filed any Section 2 voting rights cases since President Trump has been inaugurated. And also, they point to Census Bureau research that researchers at the Census Bureau say if you want more accurate, more comprehensive citizenship data, adding a question, a citizenship question to the 2020 census is not the best way to do that. Right. Actually, there's a more accurate way and less costly way by using existing government records from the Social Security Administration, other agencies. But the Trump administration is insisting that this question be on the 2020 census.
Yeah, so I think it's an important point you make that some career Census Bureau workers say this will discourage participation, which is what the plaintiffs are saying. In the New York lawsuits, there are more than two dozen states and cities that are being led by the New York State Attorney General's office. And they say that the administration is making an excuse. This is a way to discourage immigrants from participating. And that pressure came from the Trump White House to do this. Make more of that case.
I've been looking through more than 12,000 internal emails, memos, other documents that have been released as part of these lawsuits. And it's very clear that after Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was confirmed by the Senate, he started pressuring his staff to figure out a way to get this question onto the census. These documents and other court filings show that former White House advisor Steve Bannon spoke with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross about adding a citizenship question. Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who just lost the Kansas gubernatorial race, he also spoke with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and specifically was concerned that undocumented immigrants are included in census numbers used to reapportion seats in Congress. And this was all part of the conversation leading up to ultimately Wilbur Ross's decision. Yeah. And the concern here, again, is that this question, Census Bureau research, even more, you know, a recent preliminary results from a nationwide study were just put out about focus group participants who said that they feel that this question is designed to make people panic. And they fear that it's designed to help the government find undocumented immigrants. Mm. And it's important to point out, though, that federal law prohibits the Census Bureau from releasing any information that would identify individuals to law enforcement agency and to the public. To the public for, you know, 72 years until after it's collected. But many people that the Census Bureau has been checking in with to kind of prepare for their marketing campaign, they're hearing that they do not trust the government's going to keep that promise of confidentiality.
Well, meanwhile, this is reminding many of the travel ban, the proposed travel ban, when some suspected it was motivated by race or religion. But the Supreme Court said it's not our job to guess at ulterior motives of the president. We can only go off what he says he intends. It sounds as if this census case gets appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, as legal experts think it likely will. Something similar may happen, so we will follow this with Hansi Lo Wang, national correspondent for NPR, who, as we said, has been hunkered down there in New York where this case is starting. Hansi, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Let's take a break from the news now to talk about cranberries. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, only a couple weeks away, but cranberries are already filling the store shelves. So here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has been experimenting with a couple of different ways of cooking with them. Hi, Kathy.
Hello there.
So is it hard to cook with cranberries?
It absolutely could not be easier. The thing that throws people off is, you know, they're so tart. They're a very, very tart berry. So they need a balance. They need a little bit of sweetness. You wouldn't just bite into one raw. Some people do. But, I mean, it's super tart, super good for you. And I was having so much fun experimenting with these cranberries that it occurred to me that we need to eat these more often than Thanksgiving because they are so good.
I have cranberry sauce year-round instead of applesauce.
It goes beyond cranberry sauce.
It does.
Absolutely. So one thing to be aware of is that they are in season from mid-September to late November. So what I do is I find them fresh, I put them in a sealed plastic bag, and I throw them in the freezer, and I can cook with them all year. They'll last for 6 to 8 months in the freezer or 2 weeks in the fridge. But one of the most fun things was trying to play around with cranberries in a savory dish. Mm. So I came up with, at first I wasn't sure about this, it's a pan sauté of chicken, cranberries, tangerines, and potatoes. This is one of those one skillet dishes where your whole dinner is in one dish. You only have one dish to clean at the end. And to me, the flavor profile is sweet, sour, and savory, and in all the best ways. You saute the chicken pieces with fresh thyme and rosemary. You add bits of potatoes and onions. And then the cranberries add this tartness and add a little bit of honey and tangerine juice and tangerine sections, and it all kind of cooks down into this gorgeous sauce.
There's something so nice about having a savory dish with that little, you say tangy, but also sweet.
Exactly.
A little bit of sweet.
It's a little bit of everything.
It's like an al pastor taco with some pineapple.
I like
it. Right?
Exactly, right? You get the zing of the cranberry, but there's also red wine in there, so it's comforting, and it's like the kind of dish that you could eat on a Tuesday night, or you could serve at a dinner party.
By the way, I just got all excited, but the wine cooks off.
The wine cooks off, for sure. You got all excited.
And I have to say, with deference and such affection for NPR Susan Stamberg, who we love,
yes,
this is not Susan Stamberg's cranberry relish. This is amazing.
This is a whole other thing. You will find my recipe that we give every single year for my cranberry sauce, which uses fresh pineapple, toasted pecans, fresh ginger, cranberries, maple syrup, and orange juice. Takes you about 15, 20 minutes, maybe a little bit longer.
It's an NPR cranberry smackdown.
It is a smackdown. Susan Stamberg, I believe, puts horseradish in hers.
Yes, it's a whole
I do
other,
not. But, you know, the thing that's super interesting about cranberries is that they are native to North America. And most people think that they're uniquely American. But in fact, they're now grown all over the world. The story goes that the pilgrims ate them their first winter here. The pilgrims ate a whole lot of things.
They're good
they?
For you, too.
They are so good for you. It turns out they're another one of these foods.
Superfood.
Superfood, exactly. Loaded with vitamin C, antioxidants, really good for your gut, promotes heart health. And super. A half a cup of cranberries is 25 calories. So you get this pow of flavor and that gorgeous, gorgeous maroon color. Mm. I mean, you throw some cranberries on a holiday salad and you put your cranberry sauce out and your Thanksgiving plate comes alive with that beautiful maroon color.
And your tablecloth is ruined.
Every year.
You have also something for dessert. You've gone to the sweet. What is this?
This is a hazelnut cranberry turtle bar sprinkled with coarse sea salt. You need a candy thermometer. I will warn you that because you make a caramel. Other than that, it is very simple. It's a very simple crust that you bake ahead of time, and then you cook up a caramel with some butter and sugar and add fresh chopped cranberries, and you add the hazelnuts, and you let it cool. And this also, okay, when you're planning your Thanksgiving, you can do this and pop them in the freezer and take them out on Thanksgiving Day, and you have a dessert all done. Isn't that delicious?
Mm-hmm. You know, it does taste like turtles, those little chocolate turtles, that's what they're called.
I thought you meant like a turtle. No, stop.
That's
awful. It's called a turtle bar.
No, a turtle bar. It tastes like those chocolate turtles with nuts, but it's hazelnut, cranberry, sea salt, phenomenal.
Yeah, but the cranberries really, I mean, of course there's butter and sugar galore, but you've got those healthy cranberries in there as well. The other thing that's very cool about cranberries is the way that they grow. They grow in bogs, a word I love, and they grow around here, all over southern Massachusetts, the Cape. There are kettle ponds all over the Cape. They're found on the islands. And
kettle ponds, their source is, they were made by glaciers.
Exactly. Sorry, they are sandy. They have a ton of clay, and it's the perfect environment for cranberry vines to spread. Cranberry bogs are, you find them in wetlands and swamps. When you drive out to the Cape, I always look forward to this. I'm like, there are the bogs, the cranberry bogs. And there's so much history there.
Okay, so if people want to try some of these things that we've got in front of us, they can go to hereandnow.org, get the recipes, and
we'll put pictures
take a look
of bogs.
At pictures.
Yeah.
Kathy Guntz, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.